Welcome everyone to the Goldster podcast, where we take you behind the scenes with guests of all shades and styles and their enriching stories about lives, their victories, their failures, their ambitions, and of course, their books. I'm Humphrey Hawksley, your host, and today we're exploring our non-fiction library of fascinating topics. So please enjoy. To find out more, check us out on www.goldster.co.uk. And without further ado, let us begin. Hello and welcome to Goldster Inside Story. I'm just tilting my computer down here to get a better shot on a beautiful early summer's day here in England, where we are going to discuss, in a way, the undiscussable. But this is Goldster, where we explore, we discover, we challenge, we satisfy curiosities, and often we laugh a lot along the way. Oh yes, today, my goodness, we are going to delve into how we originate, not where we were born, our tribe, gender, class, wealth, none of that stuff. No, we are how we originated billions and billions of years ago as particles in space. If I've got that right, if I haven't, I will be corrected by my guest who is waiting patiently to talk to us. But the conversation will not stop there, because we will also talk about a second book that he's written about where we are heading, far beyond climate change and the Third World War, but as the evolution of the human race itself. My guest is a scientist, a novelist, too, a creative writing tutor, but more than anything else, he is the author of two outstanding books, Cosmo Sapiens, Human Evolution from the Origin of the Universe, and The Future of Humankind, which I have here with me. The Future of Humankind. There we are. Why we should be optimistic. Critics have raved about both. Cosmo Sapiens was the Times Literary Supplement Book of the Year, and The Telegraph made it its best science book of the year. Groundbreaking, invaluable, shocking, invigorating are just a few of the superlatives that swirl around today's Goldster conversation. And what prompted my mild-mannered, patient guest to embark upon such a difficult task of writing and research was something deeply personal, and something in a way personal to us all, because at some stage in our lives, do not each of us ask where we come from, where are we going, and why are we here? So on that note, to tell us what lies ahead for our children, our grandchildren, our great-grandchildren, and far beyond, welcome John Hans to Goldster Inside Story.
I'm delighted and honored to be here.
It's good to see you, John, and good to see you promoting your book with such flourish behind you. But this is a massive idea. It's a massive work of many, many years. What prompted you to do it?
Well, I was a novelist, but I suspended my writing novels when my wife became ill with cancer and had a tumour in her brain. So I devoted myself to looking after her. And then when she died, I thought, writing novels, well, how important is that? What are we? Why do we exist? Why are we here? You know, why has this happened? So where do we come from? And I looked into this and found out that we've been asking these questions for at least 25,000 years. And during all of that time, we've sought answers from the supernatural. About 3,000 years ago, however, we began to seek answers through philosophical reasoning and insight. And around 150 years ago, we began to seek answers through science. Now, as a trained scientist, I wanted to find out what answers science currently gives. But I couldn't find any book that did that. And there were two reasons for this. First, science branched into increasingly narrow, specialized fields. I wanted to step back from the focus of one leaf on one branch and see what the whole tree is showing us about how we evolved from the origin of the universe. Second, most science books advocate a particular theory and often present it as facts. But scientific explanations change as new data is obtained and new thinking develops. So I decided to write the book that hadn't been written. An impartial evaluation, as far as possible, of the current theories. Part one would consider the scientific explanation of the emergence and evolution of matter and energy, of which we ultimately consist. Part two would do the same for the emergence and evolution of life, because we are living matter. And part three would cover the emergence and evolution of humans. Now, when my friends wanted to be supportive, they said, "John, that is ambitious." When they wanted to be realistic, they said, "John, it's mad." In my saner moments, I agreed with the latter. It took me more than 10 years to research and write. And the conclusions I reached surprised me.
Can I just, if you could, and for our audience there, we've heard what prompted John to write this. So have any of you had a life-changing experience, such as the death of a loved one, a spouse or something, that has prompted you to do something? Just share that with us and we can talk about that a bit. But John, I'm interested in, when I say particles in space, is that actually our origins, or is that far too glib and simplistic?
No, I'll trace it back to the origin of the universe. And in the book, I show how, well, the current orthodox theory is that everything burst into existence from nothing as pure energy. But when I checked this, I found that not to be so. Because, I mean, it seemed a little odd how everything came out of nothing. And I've planned two chapters on the emergence and evolution of matter, because I assumed that the Big Bang theory, which is what this is, was correct. But there's two chapters evolved into nine, because the more I investigated, the more I discovered that the Big Bang theory was contradicted by observational evidence. And cosmologists continually modify this theory as more sophisticated observations and experiments produce yet more contradictions with the theory. A cosmologist called the latest version the concordance model. I think it's more accurately described as the inflationary before or after the hot Big Bang, unknown dark matter, unknown dark energy model.
So we've got in our minds, for those of us who don't know, that this Big Bang is when up in space something happened and you got particles, let's call it that. But when I was at school being taught about the origin of us, we were taught about the amoeba, which was a living thing, which then traced through various sort of things to become us. How did you get from the particles to the amoeba?
Let's go back before the particles, Humphrey, because this is what I'm trying to say. The conventional theory is that everything burst into existence as pure energy. And then that energy expanded and it condensed into matter, which your particles, you're saying.
Particles of matter, are they? Okay, right. Oh, then what happened?
And then the particles became more complex as time went on. They became more complex forms of matter. And then from that matter, what emerged was the first forms of life.
Which is the amoeba that I was referring to, is it?
Well, pre-amoeba. We don't have any evidence because that has been all destroyed. So all we can look at is the earliest known forms of life and then see it is complex, but then deduce that there must have been a less complex predecessor. So we don't know quite how life emerged from Earth, but we do know that life did emerge. So how it did, we don't know. Approximately when it did, we know. It's about 33.5 billion years ago.
35 billion years ago.
About a billion years after the Earth began to
form. Okay.
So that was the simplest life emerged on Earth.
Fascinating.
And then the orthodox theory in the UK and the USA, at least, of how wildlife evolved on Earth into so many different species is known as neo-Darwinism. Now, that was popularized by Richard Dawkins in his best-selling book, The Selfish Gene.
Yes.
Now, this says that biological evolution is caused by genes selfishly competing with each other to survive and replicate. But when I looked at the evidence, Darwinian competition causes not the evolution of species, but the destruction of species. It is collaboration, not competition, that has caused the evolution of successively more complex species.
And the more complex and more sophisticated, more powerful one will then destroy the lesser species and move on.
Yes, they're in competition, all these species, with each other. And how they evolve is by finding supportive habitats for them. I mean, just as there's matter doesn't move, it's there. Living matter is differentiated from solid matter. So life is differentiated from matter by the fact that it is able to move, propel itself. It's able to extract energy from the environment. It's able to reproduce, do all these things that, you know, rocks cannot do. It finds a supportive habitat where it can exist and it can defend itself from other forms of life.
Just to get it clear, so the particles that we began with, these are what you call rocks just then, and they can't do certain things. And then life is also plants and animals, us. So there's two forms of life. What's the difference between those two?
Right. No, that's a good point, Humphrey. I was skipping ahead to animal life. The original life was, as you said initially, kind of amoeba-like, and that started about 3.5 billion years ago.
3.5, so 35 billion for the origin, and then 3.5 billion for the beginning of life.
3.5 billion, it's 13.8 billion for the origin of the universe, and 3.5 billion for the origins of life. And that's, as you said, the sort of amoeba-type life, and that then developed into plants, and then animals, and so these forms of life ramified into different kinds of species, increasingly more complex species.
Because I've been watching, and I think many of us might have done it, David Attenborough's Green Earth, I think it's called, where he goes into the plants in various places of the world. And what fascinated me about this is that the plants do have some sort of instinctive mind, whereby if something threatening comes along, it'll curl itself up or it'll open itself up. So where does that lie in this whole evolution of our consciousness and intelligence?
Oh, it predates it by, you know, a long, long time. So we get this original crude life forming, and that evolves into, you know, different sectors, plant life, and then very much later, there's in the sea, kind of life evolves, and then one form of life actually makes it onto dry ground and starts to evolve as what we know as animals. That's very crude predecessors of the kind of animals we see around now. And the whole process is one of becoming more complex.
Okay. And you mentioned Darwin earlier on, but just give me in a nutshell, how does what you have discovered here differ from Darwin's Origin of the Species?
Well, it's neo-Darwinism that is the largely orthodox species, when he's saying that the evolution, which is caused by genes selfishly competing with each other to survive and replicate.
Yes. Okay. So you're not at odds with Darwin on this. You're sort of corroborating him.
No, I'm at odds with neo-Darwinism, which was popularized, as I said, by Richard Dawkins in his book, The Selfish Gene.
Right.
Now, he says that biological evolution is caused by genes selfishly competing with each other to survive and replicate. But if you look at the evidence, it's competition that causes not the evolution of species, but the destruction of species.
Got you. So in this, you know, very intricate 35 billion or whatever process that we're in, where does religion and God sit with it? Because we were told at school that the world was created in 7 days. Of course, a lot of us put that to one side. But is there any religion or any God, any sort of nature in this? How do you square that one?
With your permission, I'll deal with the God factor right at the end of this section where the future of humankind, we move on to the end of the future of humankind.
Oh, okay.
Because I'm putting forward...
Don't tell us, because we're on tenterhooks, John, as right. to the future of humankind. So you are going to give us a teaser about the God factor in Cosmo. But you chose the title Cosmo Sapiens. Explain that.
Because that was... I tried to... I was actually given that title by a friend of mine, Charles Palliser, who suggested it, having read the draft of the book. So thank you, Charles, for that. It was talking about the cosmos and how it became, moved from being inanimate to being sentient and the sapiens and thinking, and how we got to this stage. So how it became thinking.
Yeah, so it's now we've got some slides that we're going to have a look at in a moment when we do the future of humankind. But I just want, when you were writing and when you finished Cosmo Sapiens, and you wrote it because after your wife's sad death, you felt writing novels was not enough. What did you feel then? Did you feel better? Was it a good process?
Yes, it was intellectually challenging, and I found that good, and that helped me move on, if you like, from just being in a state of grief So I was into something where I could use whatever abilities I have to develop something original. So this is how I...
No, you explained it very, very well, and so it did help. But then you decided to do a sequel, as it were. And just before we do that, give us the top line of what you discovered or what hit you most out of Cosmo Sapiens. Just one thought of what's right. I didn't know that.
It's when we examine the emergence of humans, there is no agreement among scientists as to what makes humans different from animals. Now, I went into this, I conclude that what makes humans different from other animals is not the shape of our skulls or our ability to walk upright or our genes. Other species have similar characteristics. What makes us different, and this is the key thing, is reflective consciousness. In the evolutionary lineage leading to humans, consciousness rises to the point that it becomes conscious of itself. We are the only species that not only knows, but also knows that it knows. We reflect on ourselves and on our place in the cosmos. We ask questions like, what are we? Where do we come from? Why do we exist? Now, this possession of reflective consciousness marks a difference in kind, not merely degree from other animals, just as there is a difference in kind between inanimate matter like a rock and living things like bacteria and animals.
Okay, that's
moreover, I mean, Homo sapiens is the only known species that is still evolving. But this evolution is not morphological, it's not physical characteristics, it's not genetic, it is noetic. It is an evolution of the mind and has been occurring in three overlapping phases, primeval, philosophical, and scientific.
And what, this is a crazy question, but who decides? Okay, because I asked the God question or whatever, but who decides or what decides that we would evolve in a certain way, that we would have five fingers and then a dog would have 4 feet and three paws or whatever it is? What is the decision-making process of evolution?
Well, you're predicating that someone is deciding this.
No, I'm not. I'm asking how does it, and I'm actually asking specifically why a lion has a mane and a horse has four legs and we have two legs and I have five fingers and not six. There must be a decision-making process in that, surely, rather as, you know, a car has got four wheels and not six. Somebody decides that. And somebody decides about the carburetor and the spark plugs and the what's on the shelves in Tesco. So who decides or what decides or how is that decision made?
Well, sorry, Humphrey, but to repeat, you're talking about decisions as if there was some God making these decisions. What I'm saying is that the evolution is caused by, in terms of humans, but you start off with life. It's what survives and enables particular life forms to survive. What habitats enable them to survive? It's purely pragmatic. What works best for that particular type of animal, and what works best for humans? So this is how we evolved.
And the environment is the one that decides what's best. If any of the audience can help me on this, because I have asked this question a lot, is that the how come I end up with five fingers and two eyes and an octopus has one eye and a you know, what is that process? I'm not quite happy with your answer yet, John.
Right. Okay. Sorry. Sorry for not being clear. What survives is a purely pragmatic feature of what it is that enables that particular life form to survive and procreate.
So it adapts naturally to its environment in order to survive.
Yes.
Okay. And we're going to get, and remind me before we finish our conversation, John, that we're going to talk about God again and artificial intelligence, because they're all feeding into this. But you finished Cosmo Sapiens, and it was published as some fantastic reviews here, as I think I said, shocking and invigorating, an invaluable encyclopedia element, humanity, evolution of humanity and universe from start to the finish. You are an astute observer of recent trends of scientific ideas, and I am just plucking from the back cover of the your sequel book, The Future of Humankind. You had finished Cosmo Sapiens, many, many years of work, published to these rave reviews and everything, but you decided to go on. Was that prompted by the grief again of losing your wife, or what, did you have another?
No, that was, if we step back and look at the big picture, we see human evolution as part of a cosmic process. And Cosmo Sapiens brought us up to the present. So having got to the present, I thought, well, what lies in store for us in the future?
Yes.
So the new book begins by evaluating. So I thought, well, what are the other predictions? Who else is predicted? What are they predicting? So I looked at all the predictions and I put them into three categories. One, extinction by natural disasters, including pandemics, by nuclear war, by artificial intelligence, or by population explosion and climate change. The second category of predictions were survival by colonizing space or by extending individual health spans and achieving immortality. And the third category of prediction was transformation by uploading individual minds to computers or holograms.
Ah, and that is the, I think we have some illustrations for you to make your argument on this, because what you're giving us actually is what we were talking about before. There is threats to the survival of the human race, and evolution is going to find us a way through from that. Is that accurate? And that is in The Future of Humankind. You say we should be optimistic in your subtitle. Joe, do you have those illustrations that John can talk to? And for our podcast listeners, John is going to be as descriptive as possibly can be. So this is the title of the book, and the next one. What do we got here, John?
Well, that's primeval thinking. I said before that when humans emerged, primeval thinking, which made us different from all other animals, emerges about 25,000 years ago.
And just for our podcasters, we're looking at a clock.
Yeah.
And the clock has got certain times of when things happened.
So I put it figuratively as looking at a clock. And then philosophical thinking emerges about 3,000 years ago. And on the clock, that is a 24-hour clock, it's 2107. Scientific thinking emerges about 470 years ago. And on the clock, that's 2333. And then 3 minutes before midnight, convergent thinking begins about 65 years ago.
Okay, this is this convergent scientific thinking, and scientific thinking only began 470 years ago.
Yeah.
Which is actually very recently in the philosophical thinking. And then we're going back to Aristotle, Plato, that sort of thing. Was that the beginning?
Yeah, about 3,000 years ago.
Yeah, that was the beginning of philosophical thinking.
Philosophical thinking, yeah.
That's the Greek and Roman empires. Okay, next one, Joe, please.
I want to look at when I look at extinction threats, because one of the extinction threats is nuclear war. And what I will say is that in the Cold War between the USSR and the USA, the global nuclear weapons stockpiles are vastly shot up to over 60,000. And then when the Soviet Union collapsed, the stockpile dramatically decreased to just over 10,000. And many of these are actually obsolete and don't function. So I argue that we will not be made extinct by nuclear war.
Right. Could we have been made during the Cold War with the 60,000? Would there be enough to obliterate everything, or could there be, there could have been pockets that have, would have survived, wouldn't there? But
yeah, there would have been, because that would be mainly, that would be USA, USSR, and there would have been survival of life in the Southern Hemisphere.
Yes. And just sticking to this theme, because we are sort of looking at strange ideas here, is that if the human race had been wiped out by nuclear weapons, i.e. it hadn't been wiped out by a sort of evolutionary thing, would another animal have come in and taken the world?
No. The short answer to that.
Absolutely not. And next one, Joe. Thank you. Goodness, what's this?
Well, that's the characteristics of the human species. That I mentioned that primeval thinking started about 25,000 years ago. Mm. But we are not just thinking. We evolved from animals in which instinct was the predominant factor. And that instinct was for competition, aggression, hierarchism, divergence. And that dominated humans. Primeval thinking started about 25,000 years ago, and then philosophical thinking about 3,000 years ago. And that led to reflective consciousness, cooperation, altruism, complexification, and convergence. And this has been increasing. We're still, at the present, dominated by instinct, but that has been decreasing rapidly. Reflective consciousness has been increasing rapidly. And so that moves on to the future, the rate of human evolution has been very rapid. So it's something I'll talk to a little later.
No, that is really interesting. So when we have instinct and reflective consciousness, are they competing against each other, or is it a matter of influence though? Because we need, when you think you follow your gut instinct is a phrase, or you follow your head and your heart, which is the head and which is the heart?
Our gut instinct is for competition. And the reflective consciousness is, if you like, that's the heart, the altruism, cooperation.
Okay, but I have to put this in here, John, is that the way that our politics and our thinking has, I say, over the past 10 years with populism and this woke thing of concentrating on these the causes and that. Is this is that something that's identifiable in one of these categories that you got here?
Sorry, I didn't quite follow the question.
Well, we've had in the populism in our democracies and the election of people who are described as populists like Boris Johnson and Donald Trump, and yeah, also this cancel culture we've got that you can't speak about certain things and that certain things are more important than other things. Are we seeing an evolution of our instinct or our consciousness?
Yes, is a short answer.
Okay, next one. Thank you for that clear answer. Okay, talk us through this, and then we return to our conversation.
Well, that's just the stages of human evolution from the origin of the universe. Energy explodes into existence from nothing 13.8 billion years ago and expands. Matter, fundamental particles of matter, condense out of this expanding energy and become more complex. But 3.5 billion years ago, living things characterized by consciousness, the ability to sustain their existence, to move and to reproduce, emerged from complex matter. They evolve into more complex, divergent life forms that occupy favorable habitats, with particular life forms coordinating with each other within these habitats to compete with other life forms in order to preserve their existence. Okay. And then, as I said, humans about 25,000 years ago, the most physically complex animal, emerge uniquely. They possess not only consciousness, but also self-consciousness.
Okay, that's the difference, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So their success is achieved by the cooperation of minds that converge into local, national, and global institutions. It enables them to spread throughout the planet and beyond into the solar system.
Can I is it not the case that ants that we see in our colonies or baboons that we know sort of in the jungles that people looked at, they were, that they have that sort of collaboration, competition, cooperation element as well?
They collaborate for their own survival. But if you look at all the most advanced species, like gorillas, they only collaborate. There's always a chief gorilla, the leader of the pack,
right.
Mm-hmm. Who fights with others to remain his supremacy and his, so he can select the other female gorillas he will mate with. So this is a hierarchical system.
Okay, no, that's fine. And then there's the last bit there, and then we have got some comments that we will come to after this. Give us the next stage.
Well, the next stage, continuing the pattern of cooperation, complexification, and convergence into the future, suggests a radical change for the next distinct state of human evolution. It will not be an evolution of individual humans, but an evolution of humans as a whole, through the cooperation of minds to create a collective consciousness that will escape its biological roots and spread throughout the universe.
I love that idea. We are going to think about that as we talk, and then we're going to challenge it as soon as. Joe, thank you very much. We can return to live debate now. I'm just going to look at the chat that's come in because I can see a few things coming in here. Nettie Lohmann-Bond, Humphrey, you are focusing on what characteristics became successful and forgetting that there will have been others along the way that did not survive because they were weak or they were simply not as good, so didn't dominate in terms of heritability. We've discussed that a bit, haven't we, John? This is one species taking over from another, essentially, isn't it?
Yes.
And one will. And I said to you, if we are all wiped out in nuclear warfare, then and you said no, there is no animal or thing waiting in the wings that would come and rule the world after that because of. They're not incapable. Sorry, wasn't Vedic philosophical thinking there were more than 3,000 years ago? Well, says Suri is challenging your dates.
No, that's a very good point. Yes, I do actually go into Vedic thinking in the book. It's a very big book, so I was trying to condense it. And certainly, I do discuss Vedic thinking, and I completely agree with what you're saying. Yes, this was reflective consciousness. So that's all I can say, that I agree with you.
Okay, right, brilliant. Patricia, I like, are humans only evolving because of changes they have brought in themselves? E.g., the youngest generation is apparently shorter and will die younger because of dietary changes. our brains are changing because of the use of technology. Humans are changing the environment so quickly that other species can't adapt quickly enough to adapt. Oh, I like that last sentence. What do you reckon about that, John?
Well, sorry, that was from...
That was from Patricia.
Patricia. So I'm not quite sure what Patricia...
I think if I can, and correct me, Patricia, if I'm wrong, is that the way that our diets and, say, our social media and our computers and all that are being changed is happening faster than we're able to evolve with it. So that question about why we've got five fingers and two legs and all that came from a natural evolution, but this is a competing evolution. Patricia, tell me if I'm nuts. What do you reckon, John?
Sorry if I'm being dense here, but I'm not quite sure what Patricia's saying.
We can skip that. Patricia, you can put it into a nugget for us if you want. We've got some other one. Annette Lohman-Bond back again. Yes, we are responsible for the extinction of a lot of species that didn't manage to adapt to the rapid changes we made to their habitats. Likewise, we are evolving because of our environment, and in the Western world, we are responsible for and have some degree of control over it. And Emma says, yes, Emma, can you explain stage four, please? Are you talking of AI? Not yet, but we will be, Emma. Pauline, yes, that means we will no longer be human. Ah, that's a good one. When do we stop being human, John?
Ah, that is a very good philosophical question. I think we will... It's a matter of terminology. So I'm talking about the evolution of the human species, which is different from all other species. And I'm talking about the next stage. Now, whether you still want to put the label human is another matter. It's a question of labeling it. We will be beyond our current conception of what is human when the fourth stage of human evolution emerges as a collective consciousness that expands throughout the universe.
So let us move on to that. I just want to read Emma's thing out because it does feed into what we're going to be discussing. If AI is the future, aren't we doomed as a human race? We are seeing top governments discussing AI and trying to work with it. Would you say there is a looming threat to us? I want to ask this actually straight away before we move on to the future of humankind. Is AI a threat to the human race, John?
I believe no, because in the future of humankind, I actually examine the... what AI depends upon, it doesn't exist in a vacuum. It needs to be created by humans. And it does not possess things that humans possess, like self-reflective consciousness. So AI could certainly cause the destruction of certain parts of the population if we allowed it to do, but we have the means to control it and not. And in the book, I actually go back and look at all the AI predictions. Now, there are predictions that AI would produce the extinction of the human species going back to the 1950s. And I document in the book the whole series of predictions from the 1950s up until 1914 about predictions of human of AI making the human race extinct. They've all been disproven. We're not extinct.
I remember as a child watching 2001 A Space Odyssey, where the computer HAL takes over the whole spaceship. And that was Arthur C. Clarke, wasn't it, back in the late 60s?
Yeah.
I wonder, we've got about 10 or so minutes left before we go to other things, but just explain to us now this fourth stage, really, that Emma was talking about, or somebody was, you know, what is it? It's quite difficult to sort of conceptualize.
Right. Well, what I'm saying is that the pattern in the human evolution is one, a process of cooperation, complexification, and convergence. And in the fourth stage, it will be moving beyond that into cooperation of minds to create a collective consciousness that will escape its biological roots. And the nature of that, so far, all the book has been based upon science, but to the nature of this, we need to move beyond science and into metaphysics. Now, actually, I think there is a higher reality than humans now in the third stage of evolution, there's a higher reality that we humans now in our third stage of evolution are incapable of understanding. Just as rocks can't understand that the sun provides light and warmth, and chimpanzees cannot understand the existence of black holes.
Okay.
It's important. I speculate that in the fourth stage of evolution, the human cosmic consciousness will be able to comprehend such a higher reality. Furthermore, the human cosmic consciousness may well constitute that higher reality and be the cause of all the physical and chemical laws and parameters that enable it to evolve in an eternal, continuous cycle of self-creation.
Okay, there's a few phrases there that are leaving me difficult to, like, metaphysical and that sort of thing. What we are now here with our two arms and two eyes and self-reflection, all the rest of it, we're having this conversation. When we move on to this fourth stage, will it be two bodies there? Will I have a computer? What will actually happen?
You must understand, the fourth stage doesn't mean that the previous stages disappear.
Okay.
There will still be humans on the earth. Just when humans emerged, it didn't mean that all of the life forms disappeared. It was a development. So there will still be humans. You will still be going to Tesco's and what, people still going to Tesco's and whatever.
Okay.
But I'm talking about stages beyond that. So it doesn't mean all those disappear, but I'm saying there's another stage beyond that. And I'm postulating that it forms a cosmic consciousness that underlies everything and from which everything unfolds. And the existence of such an eternal, continuous cycle of self-creation seems a more reasonable explanation than the proposition that the universe exploded into existence from nothing, together with uncaused laws and parameters.
Yes. Okay. So you gave us these time frames of billions of years back and 3,000 years, 450 years of things happening. When does this begin?
I don't know, but you saw on the graph we showed that this evolution is rapidly increasing. The rate of change is exponential. So I can't say with certainty, but I can say that it will be in the not too distant future. I don't want to say anything I'm not able to back up.
In these terms, the not too distant future, because we've had billions of years, thousands of years and hundreds of years, is the not too distant future hundreds of years?
Yes, I'd say hundreds of years.
Hundreds of years. And how will we know it, even if we don't know it? What will be the evidence that this is happening?
It will be known by the fourth stage of evolution. That just as I said, when humans evolved from animals, animals didn't disappear. So humans won't disappear. There'll still be humans on the planet Earth. And I said, you'll still be able to go to Tesco's. But it's the consciousness that spreads throughout the universe that we who remain as humans won't be able to know.
So the consciousness will be a higher state, because it won't be a physical thing, a higher state of the human mind.
Yes.
Than it is at the present.
Yes.
And it'll be sort of out there in the universe, as you say. Yep. Whereas we will be continuing to having Goldster Inside Story and then heading off on the bicycle to Tesco's.
Yes.
For our great, 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 great grandchildren. Let me, anybody got any, I mean, this is one because I have the God question is coming up in a second. Patricia says, John said only humans are still evolving. We are evolving rapidly because of the influences we are creating. Other species might be evolving, but slowly over millennia. So cannot cope or adapt quickly enough to adapt and survive. We are adapting and surviving. Those species that we read about threatened with extinction are the ones that Patricia is talking about. Is that right?
Yes, I mean, broadly speaking, yes.
Yeah. And Suri, do you believe in the future? Do you believe if the future of humankind is dystopian or utopian?
Oh, I think it's utopian. I mean, I think this is a very positive spot. When we come back, when I said the existence of such an eternal continuous self-creation seems a more reasonable explanation than the proposition that that universe exploded into existence from nothing, together with uncausal. I'm saying some may even call that God.
Well, that was the that is the next thing. And I want to do these. We've got a couple more in, and then I want to talk about the God factor. Emma Colette, consciousness sounds the human race is here forever, but we will be heavily reliant on machines. I think what the argument is going, Emma, is that yes, on machines, on ourselves, but also something else that John is trying to identify here. Pauline Blasey, again, chilling, because you are postulating the human race, that the human race would split and it will be us and them even more. Is that correct, John?
No, it's not a split, it's an evolution. So it's a stage change. Rather, a split suggests something splits into two. This is an evolution beyond the existing state.
Jennifer rightly says an hour is not long enough for this debate, but fascinating. Patricia, with the consumption of ultra-processed foods, many brains are reverting to Neanderthal levels, not to a higher level of consciousness, and I might say with the social media and all the rubbish on television. John, what do you reckon about that? Are we evolving backwards?
No, I don't think so, but evolution isn't a continuous process. It consists of three steps forward and two steps back. And we may well be in one of the two steps back phases at the moment.
And what you are saying, I mean, you know, what a lot of people say you're being saying about this sort of, you know, we still continue doing what we're doing. And then there is evolving out of this high level of consciousness in the universe. Are we then evolving into God?
I'm saying that some may call it God. I'm saying,
what do you call it?
I have an open mind on this. I mean, I personally don't believe in the kind of God that is revered by religions.
Right.
But when you look at an eternal continuous cycle of self-creation, some people may well call that God. It is beyond humans.
And in a way, does this get back to the question that I keep challenging you on about what makes the decision of how we evolve, or how is that decision made? But I'm not going to let you answer that, because you have to sit there and we will continue reflecting whilst I tell our audience what we have got coming up next. And then we're going to come back to you, John. And June the 15th, Lucinda is with Gerald Dickens, the great-great-grandson of the author Charles Dickens, with his new book, Dickens and Staplehurst. That is the story about a rail crash in 1885, a great rail disaster. Lucinda, as many of you might know, is the great-great-great-granddaughter of Charles Dickens. There'll be some family stuff in that discussion, that great Goldster conversation. And June the 16th, that is the next day, Lucinda is with the novelist Amanda Craig with her latest book, The Three Graces, which is about three friends in their 80s who've retired to Tuscany, but they have to handle a grandchild from a disaster wedding, redeem another and save a life, and all those things that people in their 80s do in Tuscany. Great story, that. June 20th is Riverstone, a live in-person event, and I'm with Dr. Saliha Mahmoud Ahmed, and her new bestseller is The Kitchen Prescription, which draws on her love of good food and her expertise in the stomach and health and creating recipes that keep us healthy and are delicious. And that is an invitation to the beautiful Riverstone Theatre on the banks of the River Thames. Book a place if you can get to it, 12 o'clock on June the 20th, and you email joe.carterhawkins@goldster.co.uk or just concierge@goldster.co.uk, and you will get a perfect seat there and meet all the stars. And I think Jane Dorner said she is coming. She was my guest yesterday with The Stuff of Life. She's going to come and meet some of you as well. June 22nd, I am with Michael Davies, who is a thriller writer brave enough to have stepped into the shoes of the great adventure author Desmond Bagley. And he's got a new book out called Outback. How do you write in the style of a famous author with a character? His character is described as part spy, secret agent James Bond, and part private detective Philip Marlowe. So that's on June 22nd. John, we will never finish this debate we're having, but you have written thrillers, haven't you?
Yes.
And you stopped after the sad death of your wife. But tell us the question I've just asked. Thriller writing, you create your characters. Michael Davies is doing it in the footsteps of Desmond Bagley. Could you ever have done that, Britain, if you were asked, write James Bond or Tom Clancy or something?
No, I prefer to do my own stuff. That's a natural preference.
Yes, and the three thrillers, I know you've probably written more than this, Brutal Fantasies, Perestroika Christie, and Darkness at Dawn. Perestroika Christie, there you actually, through the novel form, are delving into this similar area yes. that we're in. Tell us about that quickly.
Yeah, well, it's... I thought I'd do this through fiction, and so this is what I attempted to do, and that was my first novel, and it was successful. It was published in several countries,
and you were asking. I mean, you know, there was thrillers and plots, but you were asking the same questions, were you, about why are we here? Who are we? What's it all about?
Yes, I was asking that, but attempting to give answers through fiction. And just before we go, can I say that I've tried to explain some quite complex ideas today verbally, and that's quite difficult to do, and so. I would recommend that if people want more, they'll actually find it better to read what I've written rather than just accept, you know, what I'm saying, condensing verbally.
That absolutely. And I know you don't want me to say this, John, but I'm going to say it anyway. If you go on to Amazon, we have the link up there, the hardback link we put up. On Kindle Unlimited, it is free, so you can just press a button, get it, and you can look at John's diagrams, tell everybody about what he's talking about, because it does need debate. Is this higher level of consciousness God or not, John, in your eyes, yes or no?
I'm not going to answer that because I do not know.
Brilliant. We've got Josie Morgan, riveting, more provoking, thought-provoking, please. Patricia, thanks for a thought-provoking interview. Jennifer, agree, more please. So, John, whatever you're doing next, we have one new message before I said, brilliantly explained, John. So you did manage to explain it to us throughout the thing. But that is it. What a great thing. Time's Wing Chariot is upon us. Thank you for taking us from the beginning to the end and to the future. What a wonderful roller coaster hour we've had. And thank you all for being here and all those contributions that have come in. It has been really great. Emma says, I will read your book. Thank you. Yes, thank you for that, Emma. And until next week with Lucinda and Gerald Dickens, stay curious, stay involved, stay active. I have to say, stay safe and stay evolving. And of course, stay Goldster. Thank you, John Hands, for bringing us such a fantastic hour of information and insight.
Thank you, Humphrey, and everyone who participated. Thank you so much.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening, and find out our vast range on www.goldster.co.uk. Our vision is to help people stay stimulated, active, socializing, and empowered in what we say live happier and healthier for longer. The podcast is one of many strands, which includes nutrition, yoga, art, singing, languages, brain power, love, and many, many others, more than 300, all from the comfort of your home. If you like what you hear, please press that big subscribe button and tell your friends, family, colleagues, community, and yes, your enemies too, about what Goldster does. Spread the word about our incredible range of guests and subject, and until next time, goodbye from all of us at Goldster.